You know, I don't know about you, but I found it to be very impressive. John Crawford, if my math is right, is either 87 or he'll soon be 87. Yeah. And that old bird got up here and did nothing but quote scripture for about an hour. Wow. Was that impressive to you?
Yeah.
And what he did with Bob Potter up here, how many of y'all have ever met with John Crawford 101 or 103 or whatever? That's what he does, isn't it, Steve? He'll say, here, check me on these verses, and he'll do exactly what he did with Bob Potter. And I'm glad that he showed us how to do that because, you know, working with a man's not difficult. What he did with Bob Potter, now it's difficult to start at 2 Timothy and know every verse you have memorized and have about, you know, 80 memorized. But you know what? I think if he can do that, I think I could do that, don't you? And I think you could do that. And so that was encouraging. My name's Kirk Humphreys from Oklahoma City. They always assign workshops based on the need, and the need is your need, not their need. But and so they, I'm always amused to see what they're going to assign to me. And this time it's priorities and the use of time, or the disciples' use of his time. And I don't know about your life. I've gone through various seasons of life. I was mayor of Oklahoma City for about 5.5 years, ran for U.S. Senate for what seemed like about 10 years. It was about 10 months. And, you know, this is totally off the top topic, but election night I pulled up the campaign party and my campaign manager comes out and he looks like his mother's just died. And I said, well, how is it? And he goes, it's really bad. You're behind 60 to 25, and you're losing Oklahoma County, which is our home county. And I said, well, great, let's go have a party. You know, by the time you get to that point, you're just so tired of it, you're just ready for something to end, no matter how it ends. But there are times in our lives, and perhaps in your life right now, where you just feel overwhelmed by all of the demands on your time and the things that are monopolizing your thoughts, all the pressures in your life, all the projects that you have on your plate. And yet, if we look at Jesus, just consider what he faced. He was God and he was man, so he knew what his mission was when he came to earth. And he knew his mission was the most important. I don't know what you're facing, but his mission was the most important mission that any person has ever had, to redeem mankind for all time. And so in spite of that being the most important mission any person has ever had in the history of mankind, he knows that he's not going to live forever. He was crucified at 33 years of age. And so what did he do? He spent the first 30 years working as a laborer in his father's carpentry shop. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? And then he was never in a hurry. It seemed like everywhere he went, he had time to talk with people. He had time to spend time with kids. He had time to heal people that needed healing, to deal with people that had problems. You know, man says, can you come over here and heal my son? So he starts, you know, going that direction, and he was never in a hurry. He had none of our modern conveniences. Now, if you come in late, there are handouts where?
On the aisle
right behind... Okay, right behind Don. He had none of our modern conveniences. He never rode on a train, plane, or an automobile. He was never in the movie either. He never had a computer. He never had a cell phone. He never used email or FedEx. And yet, he got the job done. At the end of his time here on earth, he was able to say to his father that I brought you glory on earth and completed the work you gave me to do in 3 years. So I think we can look at Jesus' life and learn some lessons from that. I went into... fellow that offices a couple of doors down from me, he used to be the president of the largest law firm in the state of Oklahoma. He gave up that career to go raise his own support in a Christian ministry. And I asked him about priorities and use of our time, and how do you define success? And he said success is doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. Success is doing the right thing at the right time in the right way. And in order to do that, in order to do the right thing at the right time in the right way, the first thing we have to understand is our gifting. That's basically answering the question, what am I good at? What comes easily to me? 1 Corinthians 12, 4 through 7 says, "Now there are a variety of gifts, but the same Spirit. There are a variety of ministries and the same Lord. There are a variety of effects, but the same God who works all things in all persons. But to each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good." So God has gifted us differently. Virgil Coffey yesterday gave a workshop that is about as good a workshop as I've ever heard at Key Men's. I don't know how many of you guys were in there. But he took us through a little test on spiritual gifts. But it helps to understand what you're good at. What types of things am I gifted in that area, and am I motivated to use that gift? My brother Kent and I and our younger brother Craig, we were in the wholesale business for a number of years, and we were good at it. We knew how to do that. We had grown up in it. In the last 15 years that I was in that business, we bought out 15 competitors. And when I was 25, we were buying out guys who were twice our age, and we knew more about running that kind of business than they did. And so I got to thinking that, we could teach almost anyone to do this. And so our brother-in-law was working for Ditch Witch, and I said, "Randy, why don't you come to work for us? We'll teach you how to run a wholesale business, and then we can go buy a company, and you can go run it and make a lot of money." So Randy came to work for our company, and we moved him from Oklahoma down to Houston. And after a period of months, Randy was with us a couple of years, but after a period of months, it just looked like he wasn't thriving, if I can put it that way. And we had noticed over the years that when guys started to not do well in their work, certain things would drop. The paperwork wouldn't be done right. It wouldn't be turned in on time. And I started seeing those things happening in Randy's job performance. And so I was at Glen Eyrie, and I heard a fellow who was a Christian psychologist, and he would test people and tell them what they were good at. And so I hooked him up with Randy. This guy was from Connecticut, and I flew him down to Houston. He spent a day or two with Randy, and finally he gave me the report. And his words to me were, "If you were to search the entire world over to find the worst job for that person, it's the one you have him in." And so I called Randy and I said, "We got the report. Come on up to Oklahoma City. I want to talk to you about it." And so he flew up to Oklahoma City and we had breakfast. And I gave him the report and I told him what the man said. And he started getting tears in his eyes. And he says, he said, "I've tried on this. I mean, I have migraine headaches trying to do this job. And I just can't do it." And I said, "Well, look, it's not your fault. It's our fault. We have put you in a job that does not suit you. And so we have moved you from Oklahoma to Texas. And we'll move you back to Oklahoma or anywhere you want to go." He had the good sense to move back to Oklahoma. They gripe about our wind in Oklahoma, but I know that wind doesn't stop blowing at the Red River. I've noticed that today. But anyway, we'll move you anywhere you want to go, and we'll pay your salary and benefits for a transition period. And even if you get a job next month, we'll still pay you for that length of time. And it worked out fine. He's married to my sister. He's a fabulous guy. He got another job and made some money on the deal with us. And today he's a counselor in a church. Now, I couldn't do that. If you told me I had to sit in an office all day and hear people dump their problems on me, I'd say, "Well, just blow my brains out now." But that's what Randy does, and that's what Randy's good at. Because he's wired up by God differently than I'm wired up. You get it? So the first question you have to understand is understand your gifting. What are you good at doing? And what are you motivated to do? You know, this same psychologist told me, he said, the right thing for you to do is not just what you're, the area in which you're gifted, but you've got to be motivated to use that gift. He said, I'm good at doing numbers. He says, you know, I could be an accountant and I could do numbers all day long, just add up numbers and add up numbers. And he goes, but truthfully, it bore me stiff, even though he's good at it. Now, if you were to come in and hold a gun to my head and say, do numbers, he said, I could do numbers with the best of them. But the minute you took the gun away, I'd quit doing them. So it's got to be both a gifting and a motivation. So understand your gifting. Then secondly, understand your calling. And that's the question, where is God opening doors for me to use my gifts? You know, 1 Samuel 16:7, God has decided he's going to remove Saul as king, and he's taken his prophet Samuel, and he's sent Samuel to the household of Jesse to find the new king. And so Jesse trots out all his sons, and boy, they're tall and good-looking and athletic and great specimens. He looks at all of them, and God said, no, that's not the one. That's not the one. And finally God says to Samuel, he says, don't look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I've rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but God looks on the heart. And here was David, this shepherd boy. And he was a gifted musician, and he learned how to defend the sheep out in the field and use his sling, and that sling one day would slay giants. And one day God would use that musical skill that David had to calm the frazzled nerves of King Saul. So God started opening doors for David, and Samuel coming God selecting David and Samuel anointing David was just one step in that process. But where's God opening doors for you to use your gift? Your calling is where your giftedness and your motivation and God's provision come together. Our second son, Dan, and I have three children. Blair is our second son. Grant is here this week. You know, we have a tendency as dads not only to think our brothers-in-law are like we are, but to think our children are like we are, wired up like we are. And Blair is 24, graduated from OU. Honestly, he's so much like me that he drives his mother crazy. You know, she can almost tell what he's going to say before he says it. But Blair graduated from OU, about a little over a year ago, and while he was in school, we started working on some development projects together. And so when he got out of OU, we just kind of transitioned to where he has an office at my office. And we went by for several months, about 6 months. And finally, last summer, I walked into his office one day, and I said, Blair, you know, we were down at the lake the other day, and we were playing a game, and I saw energy and creativity and passion when you were playing that game, and I don't see that here at the office. Am I missing something? Now, I just have a way of making grown men cry. But a tear came to his eye, and he said, you know, I've been thinking the same thing. And I said, well, you know, probably you're not in the right spot. I sent him to a place down in Dallas called Ames. They do career aptitude testing. And this fellow tests him for a day and a half, and he said, you know, you're doing the wrong thing in the wrong place. And he said, what do you enjoy doing when you're not at work? I mean, what do you do for fun? And Blair goes, oh, I read books about urban planning and transportation systems. And the guy goes, well, urban planning is one of three career paths that I have on this sheet that fit your skill set. We're driving down here yesterday, and Blair called me on the cell phone and said, "Hey, Dad, I got accepted." He has applied at the five top graduate programs in the country in urban planning. And yesterday he got accepted at one of them. And so next summer he'll be shoving off and going to graduate school in urban planning for the next few years. That's where God's opening doors for him. So understand your gifting, understand your calling. Where is God opening doors? I was sitting in my office back in 1998, minding my own business, and a lady called me and she said, "I've been praying about the mayor's race and your name keeps coming to mind." Our mayor had served for three terms, was not running again, and I just wasn't interested in it. My wife had run for my old school board seat a year before that and had run a great campaign and had lost, and it was really kind of brutal. And after that loss, she said, "I don't want you to ever do anything in public life again." And I said, "Fine, you know." So this lady said, "Your name keeps coming to mind to run for mayor." And I said, "Well, I'm not interested." And so five times, in one conversation, she kept coming back at me. And finally, at the end of the conversation, she said, "Well, before you close the door, why don't you go home this weekend and talk to your wife about it and pray about it?" And I thought, well, I know my wife wouldn't want me to do it, but how do you say you're not willing to pray about something? And so I went home that afternoon, and I told my wife about the conversation, and I thought she'd say, "Don't you dare," which, by the way, is what she says now. But at the time, she said, "You know, somebody needs to do that, and you'd do a great job." Shocked me. So I prayed all weekend looking for the verse, you know. And I should have talked to Crawford, but I did not find the verse. And so on Monday, I went to the office, and I called my pastor, who had been gone on Sunday, and I told him what was going on. And he said, "Well, that's interesting." He said, "For 3 or 4 months, I've been praying that one of three men would run for mayor, and I was on that list, and I didn't know it." And so my wife said I ought to do it, and my pastor had been praying that I would do it. And 10 weeks later, I was mayor of Oklahoma City. That's God opening doors. I had no desire to do that. I took no initiative to make it happen. I've really found in politics it's better when God opens doors than when we try to open doors. So understand your gifting, do the right thing. Understand your gifting, understand your calling, and third, understand your limitations. That's the question, what do I need to delegate to someone else? You know, Jesus was the ultimate delegator. He had this mission to save mankind, and he left it in the hands of 11 amateurs. And in his power, they changed the world, and because of those 11 guys, we're sitting here. You know, Moses, in Exodus, it tells a story where Moses' father-in-law came to see him, and Moses apparently was just busy 18 hours a day handling problems. People lined up to see Moses, and every conflict and every dispute came to Moses. And so his father-in-law is sitting watching this, and he finally says, he says, "What you're doing is not good." He says, "You will surely wear out both yourself and these people who are with you. For the task is too heavy for you and you cannot do it alone." And so his father-in-law told him, split it up and put leaders over thousands and then over hundreds and then over fifties and then over tens and only deal with the conflicts that can't be resolved at the lower level. Delegate. You know, I grew up in the wholesale business, like I mentioned, and when Kent and I bought the business in 1972, Dad had had a good business. It was about 30 employees. He'd made a good living, made enough money to where he was broke at age 40 and retired at age 49, so that's a good run. And so we bought the business, and within 17 months, we had lost all of the business. Every bit of it. And it really wasn't our fault. We keep telling ourselves that. But Dad's business was contracts with the Army and Air Force Exchange Service, and they just quit sending out bids for contracts with middlemen like us, wholesalers like us. And so over a period of about a year and a half, we had to re-gear the business to sell to a different class of retailers. And so we started trying to sell to grocery stores and discount stores and drug stores. But we didn't need all those 30 people, so over that year and a half as we were losing the Army contracts, we scaled it down to 4 people. And we did everything that had to be done. We ordered the merchandise. We made the sales calls on the retail stores. We unloaded the freight trucks. We did the bookkeeping. Delivered the goods to the stores. Everything that was done in that business, we did it. And then the business started to grow, and so I knew every job in that company, I knew how to do it. And I tell you, I was such a taskmaster, I was not a good boss. I was such a taskmaster that my people lived in fear that they'd do something that I wasn't happy about and I'd get mad at them about it. But out of desperation, I had to learn to delegate. Because you reach a point where you can't do it all. And then you say, but you know what? I can do that job better than they can do it. Now that is a lie. There are a lot of jobs that other folks can do better than I can do it and better than you can do it, right? I mean, they have more manual dexterity. Some of them are smarter than we are. A lot of them have better personalities than we do. And so, but even if you're better than they are, which is not true, even if you are, which is better, to have one person doing 100% or 10 people doing 75%? If you can have 10 people doing it 75% as effectively as you do, then you're going to get seven and a half times as much work done, plus what you do. So learn to delegate, and that's what Moses' father was saying to him. So the question there is, what am I doing that someone else can be trained to do or perhaps do better? Or what am I doing that is not central to my calling? You really have to define what you're about. You know, that's one thing I love about John Crawford. By the way, I had, you know, these aha moments that you have in life, and I'm 56 years old. And when John Crawford moved to Oklahoma City in 1959, I guess, you know, sent out to pasture to die or something by the navigators, I don't know what, he looked older than the hills to me, and he was 59 years old in 1979. 3 years older than I am now. And I asked John one day, I said, how long are you going to stay with the navigators, John? And he said, well, I'm going to stay with them as long as they let me do what I want to do. And what John wants to do is make disciples. And so he just kept plugging away, doing just what you saw him doing up here with Bob Potter a while ago. Meeting with men, working on verses, having Bible studies with them, going around the country doing conferences. John has figured out what his calling is. And he doesn't try to do everything. He doesn't even try to do everything in the navigator world. He just keeps doing his thing. And this conference started 20, 25 years ago with a handful of men, and now there's 600 every time we do it. Understand your calling. Understand your limitations. Do the right thing at the right time. You know, there's seasons of life, and the first thing you need to do is understand your season of life. What's the best thing for me to do now? You know, Jesus understood until he was age 30 that was the stage of his life where he was preparing. He understood that his public ministry was not upon him yet. So as a young boy, he was a learner in the temple, and then he was an apprentice in his father's carpenter shop. Ecclesiastes 3:1 says, to everything there is a season. and a time for every purpose under heaven. Just because something was the right thing to do some years ago does not mean it's the right thing to do now and in the future. I had an interesting situation last summer. My successor as mayor is a guy named Mick Cornett, and he decided to run for Congress. And so about last May or June, I began to consider the question, well, if he were to win that congressional race, would I want to run for mayor again? Now, you have to understand, it's about the most fun I've ever had working. And I've had fun at every job I've ever done. But I loved every day of it. It's you can get things done. People are great to you. I had a very successful tenure as mayor. So if that job opened up, would I want to do it again? And last Memorial Day weekend, I was down at the lake. And I'm riding in the boat with our kids and with our grandkids. And I thought, you know what? I don't want that job anymore. If it opened up, I wouldn't run for it. That's not what I want to do with the next 10 years of my life. Because, you know, guys, you really can't do everything. You cannot be a dad and a granddad and a husband and a Sunday school teacher and a disciple maker and a, you know, knock the ball out of the park business guy and run for United States Congress or governor or whatever you're going to run for. You can do some of those things, and you may do several of those things, but every one of them is going to take a pound of flesh. If you decide that you want to become the biggest in your field, whatever it is, maybe you can do that, but you're going to pay a price to do that. And that may be the right thing to do at one time in your life, but that does not mean it's the right thing to do forever. You know, we've all seen pictures, examples of men who stayed too long, haven't we? You know, we've seen the sports hero who stayed in the game long after his prime. And he shouldn't have made that last comeback. You know, as great as Michael Jordan was, he wasn't great forever. As great as Muhammad Ali was, he stayed too long. I heard the other day George Foreman's talking about coming back. I don't know if that's George or one of his sons or daughters, but you know, all of his kids are named George Foreman. I think the daughters even, I'm not sure, but all of his sons are George Foreman, right? Georgia? But understand the season of life that you're in. And I think that that there's a time when you're a young man to pay the price. But I think there's a time when you're an older man to function in that role. Function as a granddad. Function as a mentor. Slow down some. So do the right thing, but at the right time. Understand your season of life. And then protect your private time. You know, back to the example of Jesus, and we know the verse, Mark 1:35, in the morning, a great while before day, he rose and went out to a lonely place and there prayed. I was talking with the guys in our room a while ago, and we were talking about how our lives are what we decide they're going to be. Now, we can't determine everything about our life, but you know what? We really can determine if we're going to have a quiet time every day. We really can. I mean, do you have a quiet time every day? Now, you know the answer to that. But I'll tell you the truth is, if you don't, it's because you've never decided to. Because if you decided that, by golly, one thing I'm going to do is spend time alone with God every day, I think you could do that, don't you? I mean, it may mean that you say, well, I mean, the way my life works, I know that if I wake up at 7 o'clock, I can walk out the door at 8 o'clock if all I'm doing is getting up, getting a shower, shaving, having a shower, getting dressed, going and eating breakfast, read the paper, out the door. That's 1 hour. So if I'm going to have a quiet time, I better wake up more than an hour before I want to walk out the door. I mean, it's really simple math. Now, I don't know how long it takes you to do those things, but you do. If you want to work out in the morning, in addition to having a quiet time, then you know how long that takes. And if you're not doing that, it's because you've never decided to. And if you haven't decided to, then you've decided not to. Because the rest of life just goes on and it forces those things out. We were talking about our weight. I mean, I weigh about 220, okay? The reason I weigh 220 is because I eat that much stuff. And I kind of like it. Now, I listened to Crawford. Now, John talked about losing 25 pounds. Really, John's married to Helen. You have to understand that dynamic. I mean, I used to go fishing with John, and John and Helen would, she'd say, okay, now, John, here's your nuts, and here's your berries, and here's your grapes, and here's your water. And John would dutifully take all that, and we'd go fishing, and we'd get out there, and he'd pull the candy bars out. That's true. That's true. I'm not joking. So a big part of John being the size John is he's married to Helen. I'm married to Dana, who loves to make sweets and then give me a hard time if I eat them. Protect your private time. Jesus, isn't it amazing? Jesus is God, and yet he needed time with the Father. Isn't that amazing? Well, if he needed time with the Father, fellas, you and I need time with the Father. We need time in prayer. We need time in contemplation. We need time reading our Bible. Protect your private time. We need rest. 6 days shalt thou work, on the seventh day you rest. And the pattern in Scripture is that we take care of ourselves. We need to relax. We need time for relationships. We need time to step back and look at our lives and see if we need to make a course correction. You know, some of y'all are wrestling with business decisions, relationship problems, financial problems, career. You're at a crossroads in your career, or you're at a frustration point in your career, and yet you're not slowing down enough to really allow God to talk to you and allow the fog to clear. We need to slow down and have a course correction. We need time for cleansing. We need time for God to give us a clear vision. In 1988, we went on the Great American Vacation. We were trying to recreate the Great American Vacation from my youth. The one in my youth was more fulfilling. And so we loaded up a motorhome. My dad had this little motorhome, and he came to me and he said, I want to sell you that motorhome for $1. I said, $1? He goes, yeah, if I give it to you, the other kids will ask if I gave it to you, and so I want to tell them I sold it to you. So we took the motor home, and we were going to go to, you know, Yellowstone and British Columbia and Glacier Park. And we scheduled all these wonderful places we were going to stop. And it just seemed like the further that trip, longer it went, the worse it got. I mean, every place we went, it just did not measure up to our expectations. We started off in that motor home, and we'd see big motor homes, and we'd think, you know what? Tell you what, boy, we can get a big motorhome, then we can be successful like those people. And we finally, the crowning blow was when we got to Yellowstone, and we had this image of, you know, Yogi the Bear and this wonderful cabin and all this. And we walk in, and my son Blair at the time was 6 years old. We walk into this place, and he walks in, looks around, 6 years old, looks around, and he goes, this place is a dump. Well, so one night we're up by Banff National Park in Canada, and and we're camping out there in the motorhome, and I'm talking to the fellow in the spot next to me. This is not beautiful. It's like, you know, crammed in there, and the fellow crammed into the spot next to me is an unemployed tire worker. And I'm thinking, what's wrong with this picture? I have an airplane on the ground in Oklahoma City that could fly me here in 3 hours, and it's taken me 2 weeks to get this far. And I'm hanging out with an unemployed tire worker. And so I went in, we were eating dinner, and they started belly aching about motorhome and the trip and all this stuff. And I said, y'all ready to go home? Yeah, we're ready to go home. I just jumped in the driver's seat and started driving with the dishes on the table, you know, and we drove 17 hours to Jackson Hole and then 17 hours home the next day. And all the way home, we're seeing those people in those big motor homes. And we said, look at those suckers. But I got home and we were not rested. We were worn slick. Our little daughter, Annie, was 2 years old and she logged over 100 hours in a car seat, you know. And I get home. This, I'm not making this story up. You all have heard these Gene War stories. Well, this is a true story. The next day, Gene War calls me at the office. And he says, how are you doing? I said, well, I'm okay. I'm tired, but I'm okay. He said, well, I was in Poland last week, and I had the distinct impression to pray for you. And I said, well, I'm glad you did. He said, I have a question for you. And if you know Gene very well, you wouldn't be surprised with this question. He said, are you involved with any woman other than your wife? And I started laughing. I said, that's not it. He said, well, good. What's the problem? And I told him about the trip and the motorhome and all that. By the way, I got back home and Dad said, well, you want that motorhome? I said, no, Dad, I just don't think we'd use it. And he goes, I was afraid of that. But I was just tired. And I was frustrated in my work, you know, just kind of jaded. And Gene says, well, when's the last time that you had an extended time away with just your wife? And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I'm talking at least 2 weeks or 3 weeks, and you're with your wife with nothing to do. Now, we had taken vacations, and we had gone to conferences, and we had gone to family conferences, and but we were always doing something, you know. Putting on a conference at Glen Eyrie is not a vacation. And I said, Gene, I don't think I've ever done that. And he said, well, don't make any decision until you get an extended time away with your wife. And so this is on a Wednesday. I called Dana and I said, we're going to Crested Butte. And we'd been up there the previous Christmas and we liked it. And she said, great. How long are we going to be there? I said, I don't know. She says, where are we going to stay? I said, I don't know. She goes, I'm ready to go. And it was a pivotal trip for us. We went up there and wound up buying a house. I called my dad. I said, Dad, we decided to buy a home in Colorado. Long, long pause. You might want to think about that. I said, well, Dad, we already did it. Well, good. Tell me about it. You know. But that trip was the first time in my life that I'd ever done anything kind of away from the family, if I can put it that way. Kent and Craig and I had been in business, and everything we did in business was together, and that was kind of a move away. And a year later, I sold out of the business. But as Gene Ward was saying, when was the last time you had an extended time away with just you and your wife? So, fellas, when was the last time you had an extended time away with just you and your wife? You might want to go ask her that question. Protect your private time. Don't let the urgent keep you from the important. Do the right thing at the right time. Ephesians 5:15-16. Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise men, but as wise, making the most of the time because the days are evil. And you can see this grid there, and some things are urgent and they're important. And those are the things we need to take care of. You know, if your son comes in and he's fallen on his bicycle and he's knocked his front teeth out, that's urgent and it's important, right? We drop everything else, we go take care of that. You know, if your wife comes in to you and says, honey, we need to talk now, that's urgent and it's important. The wrong answer is, I'm sorry, I don't have time. You know. But there, most of our life is dominated by things that are urgent but are not important. Email is urgent but not important. A ringing telephone is urgent but not important. Quite frankly, today's newspaper and today's TV news are both urgent but probably are not important. Can anybody tell me what was on the news a year ago today? Probably not. And yet we give a big part of our life and a priority part of our life to those things. Invitations to parties have a certain urgency about them, but the question is, are they important? Are they central to what God has called you to do in your life? You cannot do everything. How do you handle those things? Well, I'll tell you one thing that really helps. I'm back to this getting away with your wife, but find a time to get away, even if it's just a long weekend. Early in the year, every year, and as a couple decide, okay, this is what's important to us this year, and these are the things we want to accomplish this year, and you block off those things, and then you fit the other things in around them. But if you don't get away with your wife and have that type of a process and a discussion, then the unimportant things are going to take the place that the urgent needed to be, or the important needed to be. So plan ahead. Schedule blocks of time for the important things and then say no. Say no to the things that are not important. I talked last year about this old house we bought. We bought an old home in downtown Oklahoma City and spent over a year fixing it up, and it's quite a deal. And so we got it finished in September after 14 months. If you want to get a divorce, buy an old house and fix it up while you live there. It'll almost certainly wind up putting a lot of strain on your marriage. But we got the old house fixed up, and it's nice. And so we had a couple of fundraisers for some political people and whatnot. And so immediately after that, we got, in the next few days, we got two calls from people who'd been to those events. One was from a school, and another was from a local arts organization. Oh, your home is beautiful. Can we have an event in your home? Can we have a dinner in your home? And we just, Dan and I talked about it, and we set some rules. Unless we are personally involved in an organization, or unless it's a cause that we personally support, then we're not running a public event center. And so we called both of those people back and said, no, we're not going to do that. That's something that's urgent, but to us it wasn't important to host that event. You know, they're having their event somewhere else, and we go on with our lives and don't take part of our life and use it in that way. If we're going to use our time wisely, we're going to have to do the right thing at the right time, then third, in the right way. First is cut the clutter. You know, I was at work this week, and I looked at my desk, and it just had, you know, the great thing about most paperwork is if you ignore it, it becomes insignificant after a while. Unless it's the IRS. I mean, most of the invitations, they're gone, and most of those old reports are out of date now. And anyway, I looked at my desk, and there were just piles of stuff. And occasionally it gets that way, and our lives get that way. Our lives get cluttered. Our homes get cluttered. And the problem with clutter is that you cannot tell the important from the unimportant, but you feel the pressure of all of it. You know there's something in there that's important, but you don't know where it is, and so you think, what am I missing? You know, what is it I'm supposed to be doing that I haven't done? And so you feel pressure. And so I sat down and I went through this grid down at the bottom of your sheet. And this is great for clearing clutter. It's great for handling mail. It came from a book called The Organized Executive by Stephanie Winston. But every time you pick something up, because the problem we have is we get mail and we kind of rifle through it and then we set it down. And then we pick it up later and we kind of look through it and then we open an envelope and it's a bill and so we stick it back in there, all of which did nothing, and we set it down. And so we handle this stuff a half a dozen times. So Stephanie Winston says, if you're handling mail or if you're cutting clutter, pick it up, handle it once and only once, and do one of four things. Trash it. Refer it. If it's something that, for instance, in our home, we have a table with three drawers. I have a drawer, my wife has a drawer, and our daughter Annie, who's still at home, has a drawer. And so when we're sorting mail, and there's a trash can right there. If it's for me, it goes in my drawer. If it's for Dan, it goes in her drawer. If it's for Annie, it goes in her drawer. And if it's trash, it goes in the trash can. And we only have to handle it one time. If it's something that your assistant at work or your boss at work, you know, little stick-it note, handle it one time, write a note, put it in a pile, give them the pile. Trash it, refer it, file it. If you have ongoing projects, I just have a file drawer right here, and as long as that project's ongoing, then I'll throw stuff in that file. Because if you set it on your desk and think, oh, I'll come back to the, you wind up with a bunch of piles on your desk that mean nothing. So have files for it. Trash it, refer it, file it, or act on it. And so at the front of the file drawer is a one more file folder that says action. Those are things that I need to handle right now. But as I'm going through the pile, as I'm going through the mail, I trash it, I refer it to my secretary, I file it, or I put it in the action folder. It goes one of those four places. And I handle it one time. That point number three there, deal with paperwork the first and only time you touch it. But cut the clutter. You know, when I was in college, I read a book called Up the Organization by a guy named Robert Townsend. That's kind of an irreverent title, but it's a good thought, really. He was the CEO of Avis Rent-A-Car. And, you know, occasionally you read some books and something in it really sticks with you. And in that book, one thing that stuck with me, he was talking about a business, but he said, take a picture of your business. I mean, drive down the street, stop, take a photograph of your building. Try to see your business, your home, your desk, your life, like other people see it. And you look at it, gee whiz, look at that trash out on the side of the building. I didn't know there's a trash can sitting right in front by there. Well, our sign is faded. That looks pretty tacky. Look at those weeds. Take a photograph. Well, what I'd say is take a photograph of your life. Does it look orderly? Does it look cluttered? Does it look disorganized? Take a photograph of your kitchen. I don't know in your home, but where is it when people come into the house, the first place they dump stuff? Take a photograph of that. And then you'll know what to do with it. Find out what's unnecessary and get rid of it. And really, a lot of it that's there is unnecessary. We found in our home has a mudroom on the back of the house, and it was just, it was a mess. And so I read something in a magazine, and in a parade magazine in Sunday morning paper, but about eliminating clutter. And so we built a cabinet there, and we have a basket for newspapers that were thrown out, a basket for recycle, a place to hang coats, and cubbyholes for people to put stuff in. And so when you're coming, where do you put the coats and the gloves and the umbrella and all that? If there's no place for it, then it winds up just sitting somewhere. and your house is cluttered and your life is cluttered. So cut the clutter, take a snapshot of your life. Then secondly, think through the routine tasks that result in clutter and figure out ways to handle it more effectively. I've got a note to myself here, and I'm trying to think what that is. I cannot remember. I'll get to that in a minute. I'm struggling with point one. Dana Istook. We had a congressman named Istook, and I wrote his name here, and I cannot remember it. So maybe God's being gracious to me that I forgot that. Okay. Second is make technology your servant, not your master. I think it's a big problem in our lives today. Fellas, I think it's just fine to choose when you want to not be available. When I was mayor, I did not carry a cell phone, and I did not have a computer. And I was mayor of a city of 500,000 people. There are two reasons I didn't have the computer. One is, we had a guy that we fired in Oklahoma City for accessing pornography on the internet, okay? And I did not want a computer sitting in my office that there'd be any confusion about. That's one reason. Secondly, I can get lost in a computer, and I don't mean lost like I can't find my way out. I can get absorbed in it. I can work on a spreadsheet, or I can just get absorbed in it. And I didn't want to get absorbed in things of that nature. I'm talking in good things that you'd be working on. I didn't want to get lost in my work on a computer. I need to be relating to people and dealing on a broader scale. If I can put it, I could hire that kind of work done. I didn't want to do it myself. And so I did not have a computer. I had a cell phone, but I left it in my car. And so when I was mayor, there was never a meeting where someone was trying to talk to me and I was looking at email on my BlackBerry. Shame on you. Am I communicating? And so just turn it off. It's okay to turn your cell phone off. Now, my wife doesn't think it is, but I think it's just fine. You know, one of the big mistakes I made in life was to buy my wife a cell phone. But choose when you want to not be available. It's okay at home to turn your phone off, guys, and have a quiet evening with your wife. You know, it's okay to not be accessible by email. On vacation, unless you have to, don't call in. You know, we had a deal, unless the place burns down, don't call me. So, but it's really hard to relax when you're continually staying with what's going on at the office. Turn off the TV. My wife likes to watch the news every night. I don't. But, you know, take a break. At the office, how many of you walk into the office and the first thing you do is you go to the computer and you pull up Outlook or whatever your email server is, and suddenly the random choice of people to send you an email starts dictating your use of time that day? Now, we have to look at our email, we have to answer our email, but should it be the first thing that we do when we sit down at our desk? I don't think so. And so, yes, we want technology to serve us, but we don't want to be its servant, we want to be its master. Then handle things once, I talked about that. Well, priorities and the use of time. You know, when you get to be my life, my age, you are increasingly aware that life is fragile and it's short. and we only, you know, the beer commercials aren't right about everything, but they are right about one thing. We only go around once in life. And when you are, and if you're out there and you're 26 years old, it won't be very long until you're 56. And it won't be very long until I'm 86. How long did it take the last year to go by? About like that, wasn't it? And so life is a gift from God. And we want to use it like He wants us to use it. We want to do the right thing at the right time in the right way. We want to be a good steward of the gifts He's given us, the resources He's given us, the relationships He's given us, and the time He's given us. And if we're going to do that, we need to learn how to use our time wisely. I hope that that when I'm 86, 87 years old, like John Crawford is, that I'll be able to look back on the last 30 years and see that I've used it as well as he's used his last 30 years. Still making disciples, still living for God, still getting God's word in his heart, still sharp. I don't want to ever get to the point, men, where I feel like I've made it. If you ever feel like you've made it, then the end is near. That's the beginning of the end. Do the right thing at the right time in the right way. We've got some time left if you have any comments or questions. Oh, it's Mark Burgett. Eric's question is, what friend said that about success? It's a guy named Mark Burgett. He's with a group called Search Ministries in Oklahoma City. But he was president of the largest law firm in the state of Oklahoma before he left there to go with Search. Anyone else? Yes, sir. You know, his question is about books on organization skills. I'm not a big reader of that kind of thing. I read this book by Stephanie Winston, and she still has some out there. So just Google Stephanie Winston. The one I read years ago was The Organized Executive. I'm sure there's tons of books out there. But there are tools to being, you know, there are tricks to being organized. I think what we're talking about is not just being organized and efficiently using our time, but using our time efficiently to do the right things that God would have us to do. Yeah, back in the back.
Well, Kirk, your PRFA, I am the world's worst person with filing and everything, and I just ran across a thing about a year ago that was so phenomenal idea, and it's called the Kiplinger Paper Tiger. It's a filing system.
Good. Good. And how do you find that? That's the trick, is remembering how to find it. But no, how do you find it? How would these guys find that system?
Oh, Kiplinger Paper Tiger.
Kiplinger Paper Tiger. Okay, great. Who else has a good tool? Yep, Fred. Okay, I'm going to turn it around. Fred's question is, why is it that he's so organized at work, everything has a place, everything's in its place, but that doesn't carry over at home? Why is that? You tell me. Beg your pardon? Trying to do it by himself? Do you live by yourself? Oh, then it's your wife's fault. Okay. Someone back there had an answer. Huh? Same answer? That answer is probably going to get us in trouble. I'm sure there's a better answer. Yes.
I didn't realize that we had a business of $60,000 a year. So when I realized that, I
There you go. I think my guess, Fred, would be the reason that we can be organized in one part of our life and not organized in another part of our life could be one of two things. One is it could be at work they helped us with that, or they put a system in place where it is helpful. But secondly, I think more likely is I think we might have given more thought to it and more attention to it maybe at work than we've given to it at home. And I think if we put the same energy in at home that we put in at work, we'd probably get the same results, is my guess. Anyone else have a thought on it? That's a great question. Yeah, Barney.
Well, I think simply stated, it's a mere reflection of our personal convictions.
Okay. As my wife would say, that's a real conversation stopper. Yeah, that's Ed.
Stan Corley was talking about motivation factors in different aspects of meditation. I think that's true. It's a motivation factor for that particular.
Yeah, I'll say one thing, Fred. I have been guilty in my life of putting more thought into what happened in my situation at work than what happens in my wife's situation where she spends her work day. And I need to be as willing to spend time and resources and thought and energy in solving her problems as I am willing to solve my problems. Yeah.
Another thing could be is that you might be so tired of all of the things that you've done to keep everything organized at work, and by the time you get home, you just don't have any more energy and motivation to do the same thing at home.
Okay. Yep.
I've got a question, and it may just be on personality, but maybe somebody here has got an idea, but I get things on my desk or in my garage or whatever, and I say, I may need that someday.
Oh, okay, but that's a great point. That's a great point. His question is, what if I may need that someday? You know what I do? Because I have that at work, and I have a folder that's a catch-all folder called Current Issues. And so if there's not a good place to put it, but I don't want to throw it away, and I may need it, and then it's not important enough to have its own folder, I throw it in Current Issues, and then every now and then I go back and claim something out of Current Issues, but every now and then I go through and throw them away when they're not important anymore. So I do think you need a miscellaneous part of your life. Now, I just remembered what it was with Iztook. Iztook was our congressman. We moved in 2000. We moved from a home we'd been in for 20 years. And unfortunately, we did not deal with stuff before we moved. You know what I mean? We moved the stuff. And we moved in May. And we had a garage full of stuff. And in August, we had a fundraiser for Congressman Iztook. And the caterers needed the garage to stage their food. And so we had to get the stuff out of the garage. And my wife was really feeling the stress. Now, my wife is fabulous. She's beautiful. I think she's sexy. You're supposed to laugh at that. Neil thinks I'm right. She's creative. She's artistic. She's a great mom. She's a great cook. She is not well organized. And she has a hard time throwing anything away. Now, I would throw away everything. I figure if I need it, I'll go buy another one. And so, but she was feeling so much pressure over there, and it got to be where it was a big emotional deal to her. Because she had to get this stuff out of the way, and she didn't want to get rid of the stuff. She didn't have any place to put it. And so finally one day I said, you know what? You're going to have to either lose your stuff or your sanity. Just decide which one. And she decided to lose the stuff. But, there comes a point when we may keep that stuff because we may want it someday, but there comes a point when it's not worth it because it's taking too much of our life too much of our space. So, you know, comes a point we have to deal with it and decide, is that important enough to give my life to it? Okay, someone else.
Do you have any advice for establishing consistency in time management over a long period of time?
Okay, question is, do I have any advice for establishing consistency in time management over a long period of time? Well, I'm going to open it up to the crowd here in a minute, but so be thinking about what your answer is to that. But, you know, what I would say is what's important for you may not be the same thing as what's important to the next guy. And so I think the most important thing is to figure out what God has for you to do. And I think there's two aspects to that. I think regular time away, if you're married with your spouse, if you're not married, in search of a spouse, no, it's. But regular time, at least once a year, get away and see what God has for you for that year and for longer term. And then secondly, time alone with God on a daily basis to where He can have you make course corrections. And so it may be, you know, first of all, you got to figure out what it is you're supposed to be doing, you know, doing the right thing. That's the most important thing I could tell you. And you know, managing time, I mean, you know, these little handheld deals are great for keeping your calendar straight. But figuring out what to put on your calendar is a different question. Anyone else have any input on that question? What's the best way to handle... It goes better, and you know, if I would say almost no matter what you're struggling with, the solution starts with time alone with God daily. I'm struggling with lust. Fine. You know, I have not been able to solve the lust problem once and for all, but I got a decent shot at solving it for one day in God's power. I mean, I just find that if I commit that to God in the morning, I respond in a more proper way when temptation comes my way that day. I don't know about the rest of my life, but today, you know, one day. A guy asked me one time, he said, "Can you live a holy life?" And I said, "I don't think so." He said, "Well, can you live a holy life for one day?" I said, "I don't know." "Well, can you live a holy life for 1 hour?" I said, "Maybe." He said, "How about for a moment?" I said, "I can do that." He said, "Well, okay, just live moment by moment." Anyone else got an answer on that? Yeah, back, Jack. And you know, implicit in what Jack says there about making a list is, you know, you don't want to be doing the number 8th most important thing until you've done the first most important thing and the second most important thing. And if you'll concentrate on what's first and second and third instead of worrying about what's 14th, because our problem is we get bogged down and we worry about, have you ever worried in the middle of the night about all the things you have to do the next day? And then the next day it doesn't look all that big. It's because we're worried about number 13 and 14 and 15 when really we need to concentrate on 1, 2, and 3. Someone else had a hand up back over there, I think. Yeah, back in the back. Stand up and say it again so we can hear it. To do what? Okay, so he's saying figure out what's most important to do today and do it at the same time every day. Okay? Someone else? Any other comments or questions? Neil? Okay, Neil's question is that people on their deathbed say, gee, I wish I'd spent more time with my family. And no one ever says, I wish I'd spent more time at the office. And so how do you deal with that? We talk about spending time with our wife, but how about the rest of our family? Neil, I think there's lots of ways to deal with that, but I think you come back to the same things we've been talking about. If we have four grandchildren, and so for instance, Dana picks up the boys on Wednesday, I think, from school. And that's part of her grandma bit, is to pick them up from school, take them to lunch, spend some time with them. They generally go over to our home and do that, and then she takes them home. Is it important to you to spend time with certain people, family members, your parents? My parents are in a retirement community. My dad has Alzheimer's, and so it's a priority to me to spend time with Dad every week. Now, I don't hit it every week, but I work on it. And if I'm ever out in that part of town, I go there. And so, but if you don't decide to carve out time for those important relationships, other things take their place. So what I would say, Neil, is during that time when you're looking at your year, figure out what you need to do with relationships. You know, this year we'd like to take the grandkids on a vacation. When are we going to do that? And just put it on your calendar, that kind of thing. I think you have to plan for the important, because if you don't, the unimportant will take the time away. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on figuring out what your calling, gifting, motivation?
Well, that's a whole other workshop. Okay, let's see, Aaron. Question is, what are your thoughts on figuring out your calling, gifting, and motivation? I'll tell you, gifting, there are lots of... for one thing, I think many of us kind of know what our gifting is, but it may sound like a lot of money. This place I sent Blair to in Dallas, we also sent our daughter Annie, Ames. It's $750. Now, that's a lot of money, but Annie came home and changed her major the next day, so that's a whole lot less than one semester of college. And she changed from elementary ed to architectural engineering. So that's a significant change.
Yeah, it actually went up.
Huh?
The education costs went up.
Well, that's okay. But, you know, the easy answer is, what are you good at and what do you like doing? And I think you have a clue on what that is. And if you're in a educational path or a career path that does not match your gifting and your calling, don't go quit your job, but begin to take the steps to prepare to where you can get into. You know, maybe you need to go to school for several years and pursue that in order to be able to have the credentials to realize your gifting and your calling. And, you know, I think a lot of times people who are close to you, without spending a whole lot of money, you could ask your girlfriend, ask your parents, ask your grandparents, ask your mentor, what do you think I'm good at? So there's lots of ways to attack it other than paying some guy $750, but that wasn't a bad deal for us. I think as far as calling, I think if we're available, God's going to open doors that take us the direction he wants us to go to. Anyone else? Well, thank you for your attention. Thanks for coming. I'll be up here if you have any other questions.